Well, hello everyone. I'm Dr. Leslie Kernison, board-certified geriatrician and the founder of the website betterhealthwhileaging.net. And this is the Better Health While Aging video podcast, where we discuss common health problems that affect people over the age of 60 and the best ways to prevent and manage those problems. In today's episode, I am going to talk about a real mainstay of modern medicine, which is blood tests. This is sometimes referred to as checking labs, doing blood work, or even checking blood. And most older adults have been through this. For instance, it's pretty much impossible to be hospitalized without having blood work done, and it's also part of most emergency room care. Also, blood work is routinely done as part of a scheduled exam to follow up on chronic conditions. Last but not least, blood testing is usually, although not always, very helpful when it comes to evaluating common complaints that affect older adults or when it comes to diagnosing several medical conditions that become common in later life. So I think it can be really useful to better understand common blood tests that are done. And historically, lab results were reviewed by doctors, but they were only minimally discussed with patients and families. But today, it's becoming more common for patients to ask questions about their lab results and to otherwise become more knowledgeable about this aspect of their health. So, in this episode, I want to cover the basics of four types of blood tests that are really commonly done on older adults, both in primary care and also in emergency care. Specifically, what I'm going to cover in this episode is, first of all, I'm going to just briefly review why doctors and health providers usually order blood work in the first place, because there are a couple of different common reasons that it's good to keep in mind. Next, I'm going to go over four commonly ordered blood tests. They're actually panels, which include the complete blood cell count, also known as the CBC, the basic metabolic panel, sometimes referred to in medicine as the Chem7, the comprehensive metabolic panel, sometimes referred to as a Chem14, and then the lipid panel. And in talking about these, I'm going to clarify what these actually measure in the body. And then also, what are they usually used for? What are the reasons that we would order them and try to interpret them in healthcare? And then at the end, I'm going to share four tips to help you benefit every time you get blood work done. So we're going to get started. But before I get into this, I have a very quick request, which is if you're here and you find this topic interesting, or if you've been finding my video podcast interesting, if you haven't subscribed yet, could you please go ahead and subscribe? It would mean a lot to me. It really does help more people find the channel when you subscribe, and it helps support the work that I'm doing. Okay, let's get back now to blood work. So first of all, why do we order it in the first place in medicine? What is the point of doing this? So the reasons vary. So that's important to keep in mind that for different situations, there's going to be a different reason that we're doing it. And the most common reasons, I would say, are these. So one potential reason is to evaluate a symptom that an older person is experiencing. So for instance, maybe they're having fatigue or malaise, feeling unwell, or they've gone confused. So we might want to sort of evaluate and be looking to see if we can identify a potential cause for that. Another reason why we order blood work is to check on a known condition that the person has. So maybe we know that they have anemia, or we know that they have kidney disease, and we're monitoring to see how those conditions are doing. Another reason that we often check blood work is actually to check for an effect of medication, because we know that many medications, including some that are very commonly used, tend to affect substances in the body, especially electrolytes, kidney function, or even liver function. So if we start someone on those kinds of medications, we might want to check after a few weeks to make sure that they're not experiencing an effect on their electrolytes, their kidneys, or their liver function. Another reason why we sometimes order blood work is as part of a diagnostic workup. So in this case, we've realized that there's something going on with the person's health, and we're trying to find out what's going on, like what's causing the problem. So for instance, to come back to anemia, and actually, if you'd like to learn more about anemia, I have a whole video on it, but anemia essentially means low red blood cell count. And so that's a diagnosis in of itself, but we always want to know, well, what's causing that underlying low red blood cell count? And often to suss that out, we need to do additional blood work tests. And then another reason why sometimes we order blood work, this is a little less common, but does happen, is for prevention and risk factor reduction, such as for checking cholesterol as part of evaluating cardiovascular risks and working on preventive medicine. Last but not least, another reason to do it is to double check an unexpected previous result. So if we get a result that is surprising, often the first thing to do is to check, is that real? And repeat the lab test to see if it's still there. And also, is it potentially getting worse or more worrisome than the first time we saw it? So I would say those are the most common reasons that health providers order blood work. Let me now talk about the first of these very common panels that gets ordered on older adults very, very often, and that is the complete blood cell count, also known as the CBC. So a CBC is basically a collection of tests that are related to the cells in your blood, and it generally will include the following. It usually starts with a white blood cell count, abbreviated WBC, and that is the number of white blood cells per microliter of blood. Then there is a red blood cell count. How many red blood cells do you have per microliter of the blood? And so generally in the body, your white blood cells are going to be the ones that are involved with your immune system. And red blood cells are the ones that carry oxygen to your various tissues. Then in the CBC, they will report hemoglobin, which means how many grams of this oxygen-carrying protein per deciliter of blood. Hemoglobin is contained within red blood cells. And then there will be the hematocrit. So that means the fraction of blood that is made up of red blood cells. And then there will be the mean corpuscular volume, which is the average size of the red blood cells. Then there will be the platelet count, which means how many platelets per microliter of blood. And platelets are a smaller type of cell. They're also red, but they're not an actual red blood cell. And they're involved in clotting your blood. So if your platelets become low, then one symptom that people sometimes get is bleeding gums or little spots on their skin because they're not able to clot their blood as well. So for the purpose of here, I'm not going to put the normal range, but if you look it up online, you can find out what is the normal range for all of these. I will say it's fairly common for people to end up a little bit outside the normal range. And there, you want to keep in mind that, you know, the normal range is, it's an estimate, right? You can be normal and be slightly outside the normal range. But if you want to know what is normal, generally when you get your lab results, the lab will put your result and also next to it what that lab considers normal. And that can be a useful way to sort of see where you're at initially. Now, along with the CBC, there's sometimes a variation that is ordered, which is called the CBC with a differential. And so what this means is that they've run some additional calculations to provide a breakdown of the different types of white blood cells in your blood. So specifically, there are a couple different types of white blood cells. These include neutrophils, which especially are involved in fighting bacterial infections, lymphocytes. And then there's also monocytes, eosinophils, and basophils as well. But that's a little less commonly done. But it is sometimes done, especially if somebody is acutely ill or there's some concern about the type of white blood cells that are circulating and is it a different kind of mix than one would usually expect. So given that, why do we generally order a CBC? What is it useful for when it comes to healthcare? So one common reason is to check that red blood cell count and make sure that a person is not anemic or potentially to follow up on anemia. So anemia generally means that the person has a low hemoglobin or low hematocrit. It also generally means that they will have a low red blood cell count. Another reason why we sometimes check the CBC is if there's concern about infection, seeing if that white blood cell count is really, you know, much higher than usual, or maybe we think there's an infection, but their white blood cell count is totally normal. That might, you know, tilt us away from thinking there's a very active infection. It is also possible for certain medications to increase white blood cell count as well. So that's why it's always really important for doctors to know what medications you are on when they review a CBC. Another thing that we can sometimes investigate with a CBC is bone marrow issues. So the bone marrow is where your various blood cells are created. And so if the bone marrow is not well, we might see low counts of all the cell lines, or sometimes there's a problem just specifically with one type of cell line. And then in general, we might want to be checking for levels of blood cells that are too high or too low. And again, what specifically we're looking for might depend on the symptoms that the person is having. Okay, so that's the CBC. Let's move on now to the basic metabolic panel, which is also sometimes called a basic electrolyte panel. So this is generally going to be useful for us to get a read on blood electrolyte levels and kidney function. And it generally includes these components: sodium level, potassium level, chloride level, carbon dioxide, which is sometimes referred to as bicarbonate, because this is the chemical form of carbon dioxide, which is more common in the bloodstream, blood urea nitrogen, creatinine, which is often accompanied also by an estimated glomerular filtration rate, or EGFR result, and glucose. So these are all, again, levels of these compounds in the blood. So it does not necessarily reflect the total body level of sodium or potassium. It is what, you know, is currently circulating in the blood. And so how do we especially use these? So first of all, often we do want to check levels of sodium and potassium. And that's because a lot of medications and certain health conditions can affect these levels. Blood pressure medications, several types of blood pressure medication, can affect either sodium or potassium or both. And then potassium levels can be affected by kidney function as well. And it's especially important to make sure that levels of sodium and potassium don't get too high or too low, as this can affect people's health. It can affect their well-being, and it can give them symptoms. And then for kidney function, we especially look at creatinine and BUN, blood urea nitrogen. Both of these will go up, actually, as kidney function goes down. So keeping an eye on these helps monitor kidney function. And then based on the creatinine and a few other components, the lab will usually also calculate an estimated glomerular filtration rate, which I had mentioned in the previous list over here, which is an estimate of how much blood the kidneys can filter per minute. And then glucose, you know, which is also the same as blood sugar, an abnormal glucose level is often, but not always, related to diabetes. So in general, if people develop diabetes, their blood sugar will tend to be higher than normal. But sometimes they might have blood sugar that is quite low, especially if they are on medication. And it might be that their medication was a little too strong for the amount of food they were taking in. But we want to know if blood sugar is abnormally high or low, since that can give people symptoms or indicate that we need to change the way we manage their diabetes or other conditions. And then carbon dioxide levels, those, especially in the outpatient setting, tend to be not very interesting, but especially when people are very ill, they do reflect acidity in the blood. And your blood pH is generally regulated by your kidney function. It is affected by your lung function. And in cases of severe infection, that can cause increased acidity in the blood as well. So it's something that they might look at, especially when people are very sick in the emergency room or in the hospital. Let me now talk about the comprehensive metabolic panel. So this basically includes the basic panel plus 7 more items. In medical school, this was referred to as a Chem-14, whereas the other one was referred to as a Chem-7. So what are the additional 7 items? They include calcium, total protein, albumin, bilirubin, alkaline phosphatase, aspartate aminotransferase, commonly abbreviated AST, and then there's ALT, alanine aminotransferase. So let me now talk a bit about these and why we use them, why we are checking them. So many of them relate to liver function. So the liver is a very important organ in the body. I mean, in truth, all your organs are important. It's very hard to survive without, you know, most of them are essential to life. But the liver is quite large, does a lot of things for the body. And among other things, it synthesizes a lot of important proteins in the body, including albumin and other proteins. And then your liver cells contain AST and ALT. And then bilirubin is produced by the liver as well and drains out through the bile ducts and goes into the intestine. So when these are abnormal, they can reflect something going on with the liver. So especially if your liver does a lot of work metabolizing different components in the body, including a lot of medications, including alcohol. So if your liver is working hard on that, we often see the liver enzymes AST and ALT going up. Or if somebody has hepatitis or inflammation of their liver, AST and ALT can go up as well. It can either be up a little bit, or if something more significant is going on, it can be up quite a lot. And then albumin and other proteins are synthesized by the liver. So sometimes if the liver is really not doing well, it starts having difficulty synthesizing the proteins that it's supposed to. And so we might see albumin levels go down in that case. Now, there are other reasons that albumin might be low. We do often see low albumin in older adults who are malnourished. So that is one possibility. And then also, again, with these blood tests, we are measuring how much is in the blood. And so sometimes levels are low because a component has left the blood and has gone elsewhere in the body. And this does occasionally happen with albumin. Sometimes people's albumin is leaking out of their blood vessels into other parts of their body, or sometimes their kidneys are inappropriately letting it spill out as well. And that usually reflects a problem with the kidneys. And then bilirubin is produced by the liver, drains out through the bile ducts. If there's a problem with that drainage, then it might start backing up. Sometimes people have a gallstone blocking things up a little bit, or there can be other things that block it up. Bilirubin is also created by the breakdown of red blood cells. So this is a little less common, but if people have a condition where they're abnormally breaking down their red blood cells faster than usual, their bilirubin might go up as well. And then in terms of calcium, so calcium levels do not reflect total body calcium. Your body has lots of mechanisms to regulate the actual level in the bloodstream. But sometimes for various reasons, the level is too high or too low, and that can cause symptoms. Especially high calcium can cause confusion and cognitive dysfunction and other symptoms as well. And then alkaline phosphatase is a compound that is found throughout the body, but it's especially in bile ducts. So if they're getting blocked up by gallstones or other issues, the alkaline phosphatase might go up. And then alkaline phosphatase is also in bones. So if there's something affecting the bones or metabolism in your bones, because your bones actually have metabolism within them. You know, I know they feel very sturdy and there, but they are still actually, the cells within them are, you know, engage in processes of metabolism. And if that is getting abnormal, then the alkaline phosphatase might be abnormal as well. So those are some of the things that are often looked at with a comprehensive metabolic panel. And I would say what's, you know, especially common is to be checking, you know, the liver function and the calcium as well. So let me now go on to the last panel that I wanted to talk about today, which is a lipid panel, also known as a cholesterol panel. So this measures different types of cholesterol and related fats in the bloodstream. And the most commonly done panel usually includes these components, which are total cholesterol, high-density lipoprotein cholesterol, HDL, sometimes known as the good cholesterol because a higher level is good, triglycerides, and then low-density lipoprotein, LDL cholesterol, which is sometimes known as the bad cholesterol because higher levels are associated with a higher risk of heart attacks, strokes, and cardiovascular events. Now, what's interesting is that LDL levels are usually calculated based on the other components. They're not usually measured directly. So how do we use lipid panels? So what's interesting is that these are almost never used to evaluate a symptom. They're really used to evaluate cardiovascular risk in older adults because we know that higher cholesterol, higher triglycerides, and higher LDL are associated usually with higher cardiovascular risk. And then they're sometimes used, checked if somebody has had a heart attack or stroke and we want to really reduce their risk, we would be checking there. So those are the most common reasons. So they're really usually used for prevention and not so much to evaluate a particular symptom that a person is having. Fasting is ideal, and that's because your triglycerides in particular often go up after you've eaten. And so the most accurate read of the triglycerides is to do it in a fasting state. However, what they've noticed is that for most medical care and in most cases, a non-fasting lipid panel is still quite useful and is usually enough. And it's important to know that because sometimes it can be a barrier for people to have to get the fasting blood test. And if we tell them they don't have to be fasting, they can be like, oh, okay. So if you're having trouble going in for a fasting test, ask if you could maybe do the test first non-fasting. And then, you know, it's possible that they'll ask you to come back for a fasting one. Often that's the case if the total cholesterol is higher than 250, or if your HDL is really low, under 40, then they might, you know, ask you to come in so that they can really, like, check it more accurately. And then if we find higher than optimal cholesterol levels, I say higher total cholesterol, LDL, or HDL levels that are very low, then we might be ordering the cholesterol to follow, you know, as we try to get those numbers more optimized. And cholesterol can be improved through lifestyle changes, actually through changing what you eat, including reducing carbs for some people, through greater exercise, through other mechanisms. And then we do also have medications, which are quite effective in doing this as well. And then people sometimes ask, well, you know, what about these other lipid tests or cholesterol tests? It's true that there are some other ones, such as lipoprotein A, which actually has a strong correlation with cardiovascular risk. And there are some physicians who will go ahead and order them, or there are some special clinics that include that. But right now, these are not generally recommended for cardiovascular prevention screening in older adults. They're sort of the recommendations, you know, in the general clinical guidelines that I've looked at say, you know, to consider them if somebody has a really strong family history of cardiovascular disease, otherwise seems to be at high risk. And there are a couple sort of special situations where they think it might make sense. But it is additional information, but the consensus right now, at least among, you know, the mainstream general internists, is that it's not necessary to get, in most cases, a lot of additional breakdown. But some people disagree, and this is a sort of emerging frontier of medicine, and it's possible that we will be doing different things in a few years. I don't know. So I'm not going to go really into like the nitty-gritty of how we use any of these right now, but I just wanted to help you all be more familiar with these four very commonly ordered panels, with what's included and what are the most common reasons that we order them. So now that we've covered that, let me share with you some tips to help you benefit more if your doctor orders blood work and if you have it done. So my first tip is that you ask questions so that you understand why a given test is being ordered. Is it to evaluate a symptom you're having? Is it to monitor a chronic condition? Is it to find out if a treatment is working or if, you know, a certain abnormality has stabilized, you know, or renormalized? And what you should know is that there's really only a few situations in which we order blood tests for screening. Screening meaning somebody has no symptoms, you know, no past chronic condition, and we're just going to check and make sure there's not something there that we should fix. The main ones we do that for right now, I would say in primary care, are cholesterol. Well, there are a few screening tests, but most of the time when we're ordering blood tests, it is not for screening purposes. So it's a good idea to ask, why are they ordering this? What do they have in mind? How is this going to help with your health? Tip number two is ask your health provider to review the results and explain what they mean. I would encourage you to go further than your provider saying, it was fine, right? This is an opportunity for you to learn more about what's going on in your body and with your health. And especially if anything in your blood work was flagged as abnormal, check in on that and ask. And if it's abnormal, are we talking mildly abnormal? As I mentioned earlier, a lot of people are going to be slightly outside the reference range, and often that's not necessarily worrisome. Conversely, there can be people who are technically within the reference range, and it's actually problematic. You know, maybe last time they were at the top end of the reference range, now they're at the bottom end, and that's a drop that we wouldn't expect. Your white blood cell count, by the way, will kind of go up and down a bit, you know, but red blood cell counts, you know, generally are more stable. So we do want to know, is it mildly abnormal or significantly abnormal? And then what does your health provider think is causing this? You know, what's their hypothesis about this? And what is the plan for what to do next, right? Like, are they going to do some more tests to figure it out? Are they just going to repeat the blood work in a few weeks or a few months to see if it's changed? You know, what's the plan? It would be good to understand that. Also relevant to this is to ask your doctor to explain how the results compare with prior results. I mean, it's definitely good to know whether your result falls within what the lab considers the normal range or not. But often what's even more useful is to understand whether this result is about the same as before, better or worse. Because again, the trajectory of how things are going for you is often really, really important in interpreting these blood work results and in understanding what they might mean for your health. And then my last tip is get copies of these results and keep them in your record system. So this might be a digital copy, like downloading a PDF of the results from the patient portal, or maybe your doctor can print it out if you're more of a hard copy paper person and give you a copy or mail you a copy. So why do you want to do this? Past lab results are among the most useful form of past medical information that you can bring to a health provider. And when you have your own copies, it makes it much easier for you to share them with a new doctor. So maybe you're going to switch doctors. Maybe you move to a new city. Maybe you have to go to the emergency room. It could be in your own city and just at an emergency room that's not in the same health system as where you usually get your care. Maybe you're traveling. These can all be like really useful times to share past lab results. Also, having your lab results can make it easier for you to research your own health condition if you choose to do that. And then people sometimes tell me, well, you know, it's all in like the patient portal that exists with my health system. So isn't that good enough? Well, the thing is that if you change your insurance, lose your insurance, or switch out of that health system, you can lose access to all that information. So I really encourage people to keep some version of it for themselves. And it's been interesting to me for a very long time how people will keep these records when they get their car worked on or their appliance fixed, but then they don't keep these records for their health, even though I would argue that your body and health is really more important than your car or vehicle. So those are my tips for making use of blood work. And with that, I'm going to wrap up this episode. I hope it was helpful to you. Thank you so much for watching. And if you found this episode helpful, if you're here on YouTube, please go ahead and subscribe. It really does help more people find the channel. If you've been listening to the audio version on the podcast feed, come and take a look at the video. If you get a chance, you'll see my key points being displayed on the screen. So thank you once again, and I look forward to seeing you all again on a future episode of the Better Health While Aging video podcast.